I don't know if this is uncharismatic, but I'll admit this up front. There was a part of me that was like, I wish I'd been invited on this show. Like when I would see you post about it, I was like, I'm very depressed. Why haven't I been asked to do this? And that's a weird, petty thing, you know? Uh-huh. It, like, it wasn't even a like, oh, I'm so big, they should have me on. That wasn't it. I was like, I don't know, but I'm like really fucking depressed. They should ask me.
It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. That was Griffin Newman you just heard in the cold open there. Griffin has been a comedian for many years, podcast host of the excellent film podcast Blank Check, and he's done a lot of acting. The Amazon series of The Tick, Draft Day with Kevin Costner, he voices Orko on the new Masters of the Universe series on Netflix. And I think in the highly likely event that they make a movie of my life, maybe Griffin Newman should play me. I'm a good piece older than him, yeah, but here's why it could work. I spend a lot of time each day thinking about, talking about, and writing about mental health. And Griffin spends a lot of time thinking about his own mind, his own mental health, where he's doing well, where he's not, what the trends are, the patterns. Griffin talks a lot about movies and has acted in a lot of movies. The way he talks about his own life has a cinematic quality to it. Lots of character arcs and interesting stories. Today, we'll hear about depression, anxiety, why Griffin's material as a 13-year-old stand-up confused people, why the bike he purchased in California was a terrible idea. We'll hear about several cases of thinking that he had finally gotten his big break and then didn't, why he took a role in a Woody Allen movie, and how he publicly denounced his decision to take a role in a Woody Allen movie. A warning, there is discussion of suicide in this episode. It does not go into much detail.
Look, I feel good today. Or at the very least, I would say I feel kind of level, you know? I think I tend towards the depressive and the anxious, and then less frequently go into the manic kind of overcorrection. And when I was younger, I used to want those manic days because there is a high from them. I thought that that was when I was functioning at my best. And as I have gotten relatively older, but still young, I've come to appreciate these days where I just wake up and I feel kind of even and clear-headed and sober and not, you know, driven by anything. But I was saying to you right before we recorded, I got the call that Johnny Carson wants you to perform on The Tonight Show. John Moe thinks you're depressed enough to do the show.
Just sad enough to make the big time.
You reached out to me a couple months ago, and when you reached out to me, things were really bad for a number of reasons, which I'm sure we'll get into. And I felt like I was too raw to come on the show. Like I would lack any perspective to be able to talk about anything at large, both what I was feeling currently and sort of my history of depression. And then I would say for the last couple of weeks, I was on an unusual high. That also wouldn't have been a great state for me to reflect upon stuff. And today I feel pretty neutral and normal, but perhaps with enough of a bird's eye view of everything to be able to talk about all the different states I go through.
So you talked about feeling these highs and kind of mistaking them sometimes for, oh, that's just feeling great, but it might be a little too high. Yeah. Like layman analysis here. I don't diagnose. I have no qualifications to do so.
Sure.
Is that bipolar too?
We're jumping straight into the deep end. I have never been formally diagnosed in that way, sort of analyzed in that way. I've had two extended years long periods where I was, one where I was seeing an analyst, one where I was seeing a therapist. And I'm on medication, and I have never had that sort of formal evaluation or diagnosis. And there is some degree to which I think that is just because no one has offered that or suggested that to me. But to be more honest, I think I have always been a little bit afraid of putting a very specific name on it.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're just insurance terms.
Yes.
That's really all they are. It's just a way of having a word there so that the therapist can bill your insurance and you don't have to pay for the whole thing and they can try some shit on you.
Right. And but, you know, there is the secondary part of, oh, now we know you're in this kind of box and this kind of box reacts better to this kind of treatment or has these pitfalls.
Let's
more
throw
than
some
that
of these
kind of
things at you and see how those do. You know.
Right. I always have, you know, when people have appraised me for lack of a better word, it's just sort of like, oh, this all just seems kind of generalized, you know, but there's never been that sort of like focused under the microscope thing. We should acknowledge that I'm also saying all of this to you after 18 straight months of near complete isolation with no actual in-person contact with other people, right? So whatever tendencies I had before this have certainly intensified. And I will say, I think without qualification, that was the worst mental health year of my life, year and change. I mean, it really, really felt kind of dire, red alarm for a lot of it. And my only option really was to try to use my brain in a productive way, you know?
Do you live alone?
I live alone. I live alone, which was a thing I valued before the pandemic. it definitely felt like, oh, this is a luxury I've earned through my career that now I get to do this, you know?
Yeah.
And I question the things that would have been more difficult for me, being in lockdown with a roommate or a partner. But I know for a fact that being alone nearly broke me, you know?
In what way?
I mean, I really, to just, I guess, jump into the deep end of things, I really felt like...
We've established that we were already in the deep end.
Sure, I guess we're in the deep end.
The lifeguard is aware of where we swam.
I'll jump into the deeper end.
Also, there's no lifeguard.
Sure. I really felt for a lot of it, like, I am not going to make it out of this. Either I will not survive this because of the outside factors of the world that are terrifying right now. I will end my life before this is done, or I will come out of this being fundamentally broken on a massive scale. You know, there was a part of me that thought my personality and my functionality will be irrevocably broken from this. I think there is lingering damage. I do feel like certain parts of me died in that year. But, you know, and I did have an all-consuming anxiety about the outside forces that I couldn't control. And then there was just a part of me where I had just, you know, I've had suicidal ideation for a good majority of my life. It is not a thing I have ever gotten incredibly close to acting upon. You know, I've never gotten to a place where that thought is starting to get physicalized. I've gotten to the place where I'm one step away from that, thinking about how I would do things with some degree of immediacy, but I always have been able to stop it before that. But talking about that voice in your head that's lying to you, that you need to learn how to like ignore and block out and whatever, it was very tough in the pandemic not believing that voice to be correct, because there was just this state of, what if this goes on forever, you know? And when I'm depressed and my brain is saying that to me, I'm able to tell myself, well, you felt this way before and then things have gotten better, you know? And then they get worse and then they get better again and this and that. But the thing I always sort of hold on to is, as a life raft, is there are times where you have felt this bad and you were not aware that 2 weeks later, you'd be experiencing something great. And what I tell myself is like, it's worth wading through the worst of it because the great stuff is worth living for. Whereas during a pandemic, that was hard to believe in. And the logic of my depression was very persuasive. I was not able to discount it. And it just felt like, what if it's this forever? What if whatever's on the other end of this is not a world I want to live in? And that was hard. I you know, at many times I felt like, well, if this goes on for X longer, if this doesn't happen, I don't know how I convince myself to stick with it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's wisdom. And
yeah,
it drives me crazy when, and crazy is a psychological term, it drives me crazy when people kind of slag on young folks, on teenagers, on young adults saying, oh, well, they're young. What do they have to be depressed about? And a lot of what makes that such a desperate situation for people is they don't have that wisdom. They haven't experienced, oh, I'm at the bottom of the well, but I've been there other times and I know it gets better.
Right.
I know that, you know, this isn't the permanent state. And it can be really, really persuasive because it's the voice in your head telling you that it sucks sounds just like your own voice and it's been talking to you your whole life.
Right. And here's a set of circumstances that are by and large unprecedented. And the only precedent that exists for them was over 100 years ago, really on this kind of scale, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's impossible to have that wisdom. It's an abstract concept, you know? There's no, well, I know this turns out this other way, so I need to just remind myself of that. And I mean, you bring up this other point now accidentally, which is a thing I have always struggled with, and I think a lot of it goes back to how people reacted to my depression, my anxiety, certainly as it was really kind of manifesting and surging and making itself apparent in my early teens, you know, which is, what do you have to be depressed about? You know, I think there's always been this cycle of feeling bad about feeling bad, because objectively, I am aware of my privilege in many different realms, on many different levels. And I feel crappy that I feel so crappy with an objectively good life, you know? And talking about living in my head and trying to verbalize things and put analogies on it, at some point I latched onto this where it's like, it just feels like having, not to overstate my life, but it feels like having a high-end car that doesn't run, you know? And people are like, what a great car. And you're like, but it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not getting me anywhere.
Right. I agree. I would feel great if I was like riding this car down the fucking highway, wind blowing through my hair, you're driving to the beach or whatever, but it's like, it's stuck here.
Yeah, I mean, if only the mind responded to logic in those situations, all sorts of things would be different.
But that's where it gets in, where you're just like, you don't understand. The motor is done in it. The engine is fucked. And they're like, but it looks good. And you're like, but that doesn't matter.
Somebody stole the actual transmission. It doesn't
go anywhere. It's a shiny shell, you know?
Coming up, Griffin becomes a strange child comedian, swears off acting forever, buys a stupid bike, becomes an actor again, and confronts Kevin Costner. And there's a section about Woody Allen that you will want to hear. Back again with actor and comedian Griffin Newman. Well, let's back up, because you mentioned childhood, and I read that you started doing stand-up comedy at like age 13.
Correct.
In New York.
Yeah.
Which seems young.
Correct.
So how did that start, and then why was that an urge that you had? Why was that something that you really wanted to do?
Yeah. To just reduce it really quickly and we can dig in, but just, I you know, from as long as I can remember, was so stressed out and terrified by the world. I was a hyper sensitive kid, prone to depression, prone to anxiety. I had hypersensitive reactions to almost everything. And pop culture was my one kind of solace. It was my one safe space. It was the one thing that made sense to me, and it gave me a language that I felt I could use. And I was a kid who just obsessively talked about all the shit I watched and read and imitated. I mean, truly communicated through it to a certain degree. And I was a kid who would like ask to perform at other kids' birthday parties. There was a part of me that I think felt more comfortable putting on my little kid magic hat and doing five tricks that I wasn't even very good at, rather than being a kid at the party engaging with other kids on that level.
Because you could control the magic act.
It's
you
all
knew
about
what
control.
Was going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I was obsessed with television and cartoons and magic and comedy and movies and all these things. And there is a woman named Joanne Grossman in New York City who runs a program called Kids in Comedy. She's been doing it, I guess, for probably about 25 years now, close to. And it would get written up in New York City that like, oh, what a weird thing. Take my dad, please. Stand-up show that's only kids, you know? And it would be like 10 to 17-year-olds, let's say. Still is. But the first wave of that happened when I was 9 or 10. And was getting press write-ups, and I begged my dad to take me to a show, and at the end they mentioned that they had their auditions, and I said, like, well, I have to do that. And it was a thing that just immediately made sense to me, of like, oh, that's a language, that's a thing I can learn how to do, that's a way I can speak to people, that's a way I can control the universe, that's the way I can make myself understood. I would not have been able to verbalize that at that time, but what I did know was, oh, yes, this makes sense. You know, it was just an immediate, like, yes, that's what I should be doing. Not I am destined for this, but it was like, oh, you know, my brother was a big athlete. My father loved sports. I was the first kid, you know? I sensed that thing when my brother came of age and he actually liked doing Little League on the weekends. And my dad was coaching and that was his structure. And the school week was whatever, but it was all to be able to take to the field on the weekend. And as much as it sounds very different, doing this stand-up shit was that for me. It was like, this is what I should be doing. Of course this is what I should be doing. Not that I should have a career doing this. You know, we didn't get paid for doing these shows. It was one show a month, workshops, you know, to run through new material, I guess once a month, maybe the weekend before that. This woman would rent out, it started out at Caroline's and then it was like Gotham Comedy Club. But so it was playing at like real places, but her whole smart kind of business thing was they're not booking shows on weekend afternoons. That's just time when they're closed, we'll fill it up with kids and their parents. I was playing to kids and their parents. I wasn't on, you know, bills with Ted Alexandro, you know, doing drop-in sets at the Cellar. It was within this very controlled sort of system, you know? But it was just, that's a language for me. Now, I think back to what my stand-up was at the time. It could not have been more impersonal.
Yeah.
You know?
I
was talking about politics. It sounds like a joke, but like a lot of the other kids, you know, who were very good, were doing what you would expect a kid doing stand-up to do. A lot of jokes about your parents and the teacher you hate and homework and what have you, right? And those kinds of subjects filtered through the standards of 90s stand-up comedy, right? Like feeling like any Comedy Central set you would see at that time, that sort of energy. And my dad, as I said, you know, who I'm very close with, but I did feel that thing as a kid where it was like, I don't like sports. I'm the son who doesn't like sports. That clearly was a thing that I internalized from the get-go. My father wanted to be able to share with a son. And then 3 years later, the son was born who he could do that with. And so I think I was constantly looking for ways to relate to my father. My father worked a lot during the week. The weekend was the time we really spent with him. But he was obsessive about his Sunday morning lineup of political shows. Meet the Press and David Brinkley and the McLaughlin Group and all of that. And so I very quickly learned he's very focused on these shows. I'm not going to be able to leverage TV time here, right? And if I'm going to be able to spend time with him on Sunday afternoons, I need to engage with these shows, which to a kid are very boring. But what I realized was I can figure out how to make surface level jokes about things that are happening. I can do SNL style impressions of these people. I can pick up on what their tics and their characteristics are. I don't understand fucking policy or infrastructure at all. I don't understand any of the subjects they're talking about, but I can learn the rhythms of what these guys' games are. And so then I went to this workshop and I remember, you know, the workshops would be like the kids who had already gotten past and were in the system, the rotation for the shows, and then kids coming and trying out to see if they could make the cut, right? So you're watching the people who have passed work their new material and you're watching people like belly flop. And a lot of it was someone comes, they think they'd be good, they get up, they bomb, they never come back ever again. And the first time I went, there was a kid who had been there clearly four times, and they went like, Eddie, I think you're finally ready for the big show. And he did the double fist pump, and his parents were in the crowd. And I was like, I'm going to be Eddie. I'm going to be the next Ed Ubell. Like, that's, I'm going to stick with this until I'm good. And I bombed the first time. I don't remember what I did, really, you know, but I just remember feeling like I'm a funny kid. People laugh at me. I'll get up and say the things I'd say on the playground, and it bombed. And at some point between that and the fourth workshop, when I got past, I cracked onto, well, that political stuff makes my dad laugh. And the people who are deciding whether or not you pass are adults. I don't think I was thinking that strategically, but unsurprisingly, when I got up and started doing those bits, they went over very well because it was fucking bizarre. It seemed like a stunt act. I was the smallest kid in the world. I was so tiny. I was so frail. My voice was so high-pitched. All my clothes were oversized. And I was getting up there and doing John McLaughlin bits, you know? Which to me was organic. Well, that's the thing that makes my dad laugh. I'm following Pavlovian response here. But to them, I think was very bizarre. And I did well doing these shows because parents would just sort of be like, what the fuck is this? You know? But it was totally impersonal. I was saying nothing about myself, and I wasn't even doing the base level kid jokes that other kids were doing. I'm not saying base level in reductive ways, but it jokes that in any way spoke to the experience of being a child. I was just doing little Dana Carvey, you know?
Right, right. And everybody else was doing little Jerry Seinfeld.
Right. And it's not even that my act was impression based or that I was particularly adept at impressions. It was just that I was cracking, oh, this is what that guy does.
So you go to Cal Arts to study acting, correct?
Incorrect. I went there to study live action filmmaking.
Filmmaking. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I very much thought I was going to be a very, very serious film director who would never perform ever again. I obviously had this performance-y background as a kid, and then as I got more and more depressed in my teen years and more sort of pretentious and in my head, I resented the fact that people thought I was funny.
Mm.
And I very much wanted to clean slate, show up in a new place, and be Stanley Kubrick, be elusive and mysterious and humorless, and people would then be astonished when they heard, in fact, he used to tell jokes when he was 13. This was my self-mythologizing in my head. And I really liked the filmmaking. I was very, very obsessed with making short films in high school, and I think pretty good at it. But I was making this very strategic choice of, this is the only thing, and I'm going to exclude and delete every other part of who I am up until this point and make that the solitary thing.
And then you leave to do comedy and acting after a year.
Less than 8 months. Yeah. It so quickly unraveled.
Mm. How, you know? So and why?
I mean, it's a dumb anecdote, but it is a really clean one. I grew up in New York City. I go to CalArts, which is, for those who don't know, in Valencia, which is like a very kind of hermetic suburb outside of LA, but about an hour outside of LA. So I'm going from being a kid who lives in New York City and has all this access and this freedom and this autonomy to a major city, to then being stuck in like a very small college at the top of a hill that's surrounded by gated identical housing communities and one mall, right? And people were like, you're going to school in California, you need to learn how to drive. Cars are a thing that give me a lot of anxiety. I still don't know how to drive to this day. It's one of those things where I've just been like, I don't think I can do that. I don't even want to try to do it. Even if I were able to get a license, I wouldn't trust myself to not fuck it up. It's a huge anxiety thing for me, point. So people would be like, well, you're not going to be able to survive this. And I would say, I'll get a bicycle. It'll be fine. Just absolutely moronic chain of thought. But here I am. I'm in a new school. I'm meeting new friends. I get there. And at first it feels idyllic. I make like 5 good friends within the first day of orientation. I feel like I have a group. One guy has a car. We're going around. We're hanging out. I'm meeting other people in the program. I feel good about like the work I'd done in high school and coming into that and building off of that momentum and what have you. And maybe my second or third day there before classes have started, I say to the other people in this group, mind you, I'm trying to reinvent myself as not a clown, right?
Right, right.
You know, if not taken dead seriously, I don't want to be thought of as the funny person. It was a thing that bugged me that when I made short films, people would say, I don't get it. Where are the jokes? Right. And I think I had this complex, not that they were like very solemn, but people would look at these movies and go like, is it a parody? Like, what is this? And I didn't want to be saddled with that expectation. So like day 2 of being there, I asked this group of friends I've made to drive me to Walmart to get a bicycle so that I'll have my bicycle. And we're looking at all the bicycles there, and they have a children's fixed gear bicycle that is designed to look like an X Game BMX bike.
Uh-huh.
It is a crappy children's bicycle that just has like 20 pounds of plastic bullshit on top of it to make it look like a motorbike. And one of them says, how funny would it be if you got that and rode that around? And I went, yes, it would. I'm buying that bicycle. And it took 2 days for like the idea of the bit to override any practical consideration. It was a terrible bike to own. The school was, as I said, on the top of a hill. It was a fixed gear bicycle. If I was going from the school to the mall, I was zooming. And then after I left the mall, I would have to push a bike up a hill for an hour. But already it was like, you know, the way people talk about closeted impulses that take years for them to reconcile, you know, but that would flare up in some sort of way. It was like, I'm serious. I cannot resist the comedy of buying this stupid bicycle. You know, and it was that. It was starting to spend more time talking to acting students and being like, fuck, I'm really getting off on hearing them talk about the process of performing and their internalization of it, you know, all these sorts of things. And I had met an agent socially who they were looking for a kid for a David O. Russell movie that never ended up getting made. And I had a background in performing. I went to some adult cocktail party with my parents and was talking to this guy. And then he was like, I'm an agent. Everyone's looking to cast this part in this movie. They can't find a kid. Do you act? You seem like the kind of person they're looking for. And I said, like, I don't know. I kind of used to do that. I'm not really into that anymore. Right. But I had this guy's number and I'm really depressed at school. This is like 6 months in. And I emailed that guy and go like, I don't know if you remember me. I'm in LA. I'm questioning all my life decisions that led me to this point. And I'm wondering whether I actually want to be a performer. And I've been denying that. Is there any way you guys would put me up for auditions? And his assistant emailed back and was like, sure, why not? If something comes across my desk. They sent me in for one thing and I worked really fucking hard on it because I think I was looking for an excuse to drop out of college. And I didn't get the part. I didn't get a callback, but I got good feedback. And this guy called me back and went, I don't know who you are. You were on a list that my boss sent me, you know, but you got good feedback. I'll try to find more stuff for you. The writer's strike happens the next day.
Oh, wow.
This was in 2008. And I tough it out through a couple more months of school. And then right around the time the writer's strike was resolving, maybe I reach out to the guy and go, like, I'm thinking, the assistant, by the way, to the guy, I go, I'm thinking about dropping out of school. If I were to do this, would you, like, put me up for stuff? And he went, yeah, I want to be an agent. I'm looking for, like, a client to develop so I can figure out how this works. If you are cool with being used as a guinea pig, that, sure. And so I dropped out and started doing open mics, taking improv classes again. I mean, I'm 19, so the fact that I fucking did this shit when I was 13 means nothing. You know, I hadn't done it in years and just auditioning like crazy.
Wow. And then the IMDb fills up pretty quick. There's a lot of stuff on here from like right out of the gate with some of the work. Are you, so you go out, you're getting cast.
Yeah.
Are you,
I mean, are look, you... look, like not glorious projects. Like, yes, sure. If you look at my IMDb, there are a lot of credits from an early date. None of them are anything that anyone's heard of. And most of them are vaguely calamitous. But yes, I especially now with distance, recognize the fact that I dropped out of school in February and was booking roles by October or November is insane. Now that I know how the industry works, you know, for those 6 or 7 months, I was like, why is this taking so long? Why is no one hiring me? And now I'm like, I cannot believe I actually translated that into work that quickly.
So my question then is, if you were reinventing yourself as a filmmaker, sure, and then you are then writing funny bicycles and dropping out to do funny things,
yeah,
did it feel like, oh, okay, I have come home to the truth. I have accepted my reality and maybe got some peace from that. Or is it, oh shit, now I'm back doing the circus act again?
No, like, no, I will say it was the former. I felt at peace with all this stuff and kind of empowered and weaponized in like, well, now I can make a career of it. Like, now I know what I'm doing. I'm not in denial. That having been said, the thing very much became, I need to be successful. Like, I need the validation of this, you know? This is no longer a weekend activity. It became, if I can turn this into success, the things I've always felt, or at least in recent years have felt a little bit of embarrassment or shame around, if I can turn this into a career, that will solve all my problems. It went to a new era of career success will solve my depression.
Yeah, okay. Achieve my way out of it.
Yes. So I was very much at peace with all the things that I innately did. And if anything, there's the weird, you have to become even more aware of who you are and how people view you when you are auditioning and doing comedy and shit like this. Because I'd go into auditions as a very insecure 19-year-old. People go like, you're good. I get it. The whole kind of like dorky,
insecure,
nervous
19-year-old.
Right. Bit. Like, people are telling you exactly what you are. And I just, for the first time in my life, was going, okay, yeah, sure. Yes, that's, I'm going to be as good at that as possible. I'm going to own this as much as possible. Because if I can do that in a movie and people like it, then I will be happy for the rest of my life. It was that binary where I really thought, well, if I find my super bad, I will be happy, period.
Because clearly somebody who's had that level of success couldn't be miserable.
Fundamentally thought.
That's just logic, according to the illogical setup.
I know there are self-destructive famous people at this point in time, right? I know there are famous people who are famously miserable. But I thought, well, I'm not one of them. My depression is circumstantial. I'm depressed all the time because I don't like my life.
Mm.
And people can say, well, look at you. You're lucky. You're privileged, this and that. And I would say to them, yeah, but I don't want to be that. I want to be this. And if I were this, if I were actualizing the things I want to be, then I would be happy. If I had a girlfriend and I had a big, shiny career, I would be happy. Because, of course, what would be left for me to be upset about? I really was in denial until about 23 or 24 that my depression was innate, even though it had plagued me for so long. And my anxiety as well plagued me for so long from such a young age to a point where people were kind of perplexed by how dark or haunted or overreactive I was to certain things. I just went, well, that's just because the things were wrong, to the point of why I think I was able to start booking roles pretty quickly and working pretty quickly. Although, you know, of course, living through that, the time between jobs feels interminable. You know, I was working more frequently than I was at later periods of my time, but it felt very aggravating because I wanted more and I wanted the brass ring. I wanted the big breakthrough thing, whatever it was. I think it was just I was so single-mindedly obsessive about this shit, you know? I don't think I was better than other people. I don't think I had innate talent. I, in fact, feel like that period was me unlearning a lot of things and realizing how to actually do this outside of just you're cute for a kid, you're good for a school play, right? Whatever kind of innate ability I had, I very quickly realized was not enough. But I was just all in on A, this is going to solve all my problems, and B, I just dropped out of college and everyone around me thinks I'm a fucking idiot. I need to prove everyone wrong and get happy.
I wonder, as an actor with, like you say, an innate depression that needs to be addressed, that needs to be managed.
Yeah.
And you're going out and, I mean, the acting business is brutal on the best days.
Horrible.
You're going up there and people are judging you and people are saying, well, I know you want to do this art, but we won't let you because you're this. How do you develop a sense of I'm fine or I'm fine enough anyway? Or do you?
I never stopped absorbing things, you know, but I don't think I built a block or a wall against it. I do think I just developed a certain numbness of this is necessary. This is what I have to go through in order to get the thing. I really just felt like if I can be Michael Cera, then everything will be validated. And so whatever I have to go through to get to that point, however many people go like, eh, you're not very good, or even, as we were saying, compliment me in a way that is objectively kind of cutting, you know, it was just like, well, it's all going to be worth it. Like, I was just so single-minded about this, and it was just about end goal. I thought there would be one job I would get that would make me successful. You are now famous. We can never revoke that status. And you will work for the rest of your life. And it also felt like if I can take all the things I hate about myself and turn them into a career and people like those qualities that I am embarrassed by, then I will no longer feel embarrassed by them. It's the control thing, as you said. Now, as opposed to when I was 13, I'm putting it all on the line. I'm trying to weaponize all of my insecurities and my weaknesses and turn them into a thing. You know,
now, like persona. Right now or now at that
earlier age.
Point? Yeah, at that age.
At that age. Yeah.
You know, I have to say, and I don't know how big the audience was for this movie, but Draft Day with Kevin Costner, I was watching. Yeah. I'm a sports draft guy. And so I've watched it a couple times. And the last time I watched it having known you through Twitter a little bit. And it really, the performance really stuck with me because you're the harried assistant, which I know you've played many times.
That was, yes, the pinnacle after, like, you know, 6 or 7 other build-up roles to playing a high-level harried assistant.
But that high-level harried assistant.
That was my typecasting at the time, yes.
But there's a moment in it where, and I don't know how the editing all worked out, what they left in, what they took out.
Sure.
But the character displays a real edge. Like he has had enough of Kevin Costner's bullshit and just like a few non-funny, really stinging moments. And I wonder if that, as somebody with the mental health history you had, was kind of satisfying. That it was the harried assistant, but he kind of becomes a full human with negative emotions in that moment. Or do you even remember playing?
No. I do. I have a lot of thoughts, and I'm trying to figure out how to package them. I don't say this to give myself credit, but as I remember it, that was very distinctly my choice. That's probably the moment in the film I'm proudest of. And I've never had someone call it out in that way before, but I remember that being a very conscious thing for me. And I don't, as I remember it on the page, it was not necessarily written with that sort of edge to it. I think it was maybe conceived as being a little more sad sacky, because for those who haven't seen the movie, which is the vast majority of the American population, judging by the box office, he's a befuddled intern who gets promoted to this being this guy's assistant on the biggest day of the year because the actual assistant has mono. So he's working for the guy, the Kevin Costner hero, who's the GM, having to make the crazy decision on the day of the draft, and this kid's being thrown to the deep end. And he's a nervous, shy, frazzled dude, harried, as you said, having all this shit put upon him. And 90% of the movie is the comedy of him panicking and shaking and trying to figure out how to do everything, right? And then, as you said, there's this one moment that I won't ruin, not that it's a big twist, but where shit kind of piles up on him, and you have this scene where he's expressing genuine vulnerability. You're seeing that this day has gotten to this kid, and as Costner engages with him, he kind of pushes back, right? There's a, as you said, a little more edge or bite to it. And throughout these years, I mean, at that point where I do that movie, I think 24. I've been doing this for 5 years, you know. This movie, this role is kind of, on paper at least, the thing I had been working towards. People thought this was going to be a big hit movie, and I was like going to be a, if this was a hit, then that's, he'll pop from this because he's a young discovery and he's got all these big scenes and whatever. And it didn't work out that way, but I definitely went into that movie going like, well, this is that shot you've been waiting for, you know? And in those 5 years of doing all those auditions and getting some parts, but parts that went nowhere, things that never got seen or never got released, being able to do a series of assistant, harried assistant roles working up to this one. And also then at this point, watching movies that I auditioned for and didn't get and seeing what people did in the final position. As much as I'm talking about trying to, my complex at this time of trying to weaponize everything I hated about myself and turn it into something funny that I could control, I also became very obsessed with the idea of integrity within that, and that I felt like a lot of actors want to believe they are blank slates, that they can just do anything, and that if they are handed a role, they need to work to figure out who that guy is, right? And transform into that character. And I have always been of the mind that you want to figure out a way to bring the character to you as much as possible. Not that I wouldn't adjust, you know, if a thing demanded more of a transformation for me. But I think if you can bring the thing closer to you, it lets you live in it a little more and find moments and discoveries that are more organic and reactive rather than having to build an entire character where you have to be a little more constructive in what you're doing, if that makes sense. And so watching all these, reading all these scripts, going in all these auditions, seeing other people do it, I got very frustrated with what I felt were a lot of actors who were like me, but did not want to admit that they were in fact dorky or come off as being sensitive or frazzled or anxious. They want to believe that they could play the cool guy. And when they're playing the harried assistant, they are trying their hardest to be like, what would it be like to be frantic? What would it be like to be a dork? Right?
Right. Right.
And there was a sense of condescension in it. There was a sense of winking, and I could feel the actors being like, this character I'm playing is a loser. Yeah. And I always sort of told myself, if I get to play these parts, I'm going to try to play them with as much integrity as possible. And part of that was, I think, in that scene, trying to give that guy some agency. Mm-hmm. And a thing where I just feel like you don't see that from those types of characters in movies. You're not expecting them to sort of step up at any point in time.
Yeah.
And so that was like, that was a big thing for me. That I really wanted to do with that part. Yeah. Now, you asking if that's a manifestation of everything I was feeling at the time, probably that's why I had the inclination to do that in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But it yeah. was a deliberate sort of creative choice for me, probably coming from a well of feeling that I knew all too well.
Yeah. Yeah, it was in the toolbox.
Yeah.
Just ahead, Griffin Newman nearly quits acting again, then ends up in the role of his dreams and the experience of his nightmares. Woody Allen is involved.
Video games.
Video games.
Video
games. You like them?
Maybe you wish you had more time for them?
Maybe you want to know the best ones to play?
Maybe you want to know what happens to Mario when he dies?
In that case, you should check out Triple Click. It's a podcast about video games.
A podcast about video games? But I don't have time for that.
Sure you do. Once a week, kick back as three video game experts give you everything from critical takes on the hottest new releases,
to scoops, interviews, and explanations about how video games work,
to fascinating and sometimes weird stories about the games we love.
Triple Click is hosted by me, Kirk Hamilton.
Me, Jason Schreier.
And me, Maddie Myers.
You can find Triple Click wherever you get your podcasts and listen at MaximumFun.org.
Bye.
Hey, kid. Your dad tell you about the time he broke Steven Dorff's nose at the Kids' Choice Awards?
In Dead Pilot Society, scripts that were developed by studios and networks but were never produced are given the table reads they deserve.
When I was a kid, I had to spend my Christmas break filming a PSA about angel dust. So yeah, being a kid sucks sometimes.
Presented by Andrew Reich and Ben Blacker. Dead Pilot Society, twice a month on MaximumFun.org.
You know, the show you like, that hobo with the scarf who lives in a magic dumpster.
Doctor Who?
Yeah!
Back again with Griffin Newman, star of the TV series The Tick, featured character in the 2019 Woody Allen film A Rainy Day in New York. Now, if you're a particular kind of fan of comedy, comics, and the intelligent execution of both, you may have already heard of The Tick. You may already be a fan. Started as a comic by Ben Edlund, it was first a cartoon on TV in 1994, a live-action series on network TV starring Patrick Warburton as The Tick in 2001, and another live-action series on Amazon in 2016, where the lead character was really not so much The Tick as it was Arthur, The Tick's sidekick, who was played by Griffin Newman. Getting that role, that almost didn't happen. Anxiety and depression really don't blend well with the life of a professional actor, and Griffin was ready to take a long break.
So I had drafted an email to my agents to say, I'm just going to focus on stand-up, I want to make that my priority, and don't put me up for any auditions for a year. And the last email I got for an audition before that was The Tick. And I went, well, fuck, this is The Tick, I love The Tick, I've loved The Tick. The press versions growing up, I need to do this. And I open the email and I see that it's Arthur. Oh, wow, that's the other big part in The Tick. Holy shit, this isn't playing the pizza guy. This is the big part. I can't not see if I could do this. And then I read the pilot. And as you said, that show is entirely retold through the prism of mental health. Ben Edlund, the creator of The Tick, who created the character when he was 16 years old, created the comic book, the cartoon show, the Warburton show, and this show, has been in charge of The Tick in every permutation, but every time he tries to do something new with it. And that was his big take this time. Arthur is now the protagonist of the show. It's being told through him as opposed to The Tick, and it is a story about mental illness and how one deals with that themselves and how people perceive you on the outside. And it felt like, this is the thing I've been working towards my entire career. This is everything I would like to say creatively as an actor. And here's a character that I think a lot of other people could turn into a joke. And I'm ready to take this very, very seriously. I think I have enough experience in comedy that I can land the jokes where they're needed, but I really want to play this straight in terms of what this character's struggle is and what he's going through. And so I bust my ass trying to get this part, but also tell myself, and if I don't get it, I'm sending that email, I'm done, right? And somehow through a confluence of weird events, I get the role. It was truly one of these machination things where for some reason out of nowhere, some other thing wanted me. And I don't think Amazon ever would have hired me because they wanted a name actor to lead their very expensive show. But suddenly there was a ticking shot clock where they said, this other show wants him. And if you don't move ahead in 48 hours, he might be unavailable. And Ben had always wanted me. I don't think they were ever going to approve me, but Ben had said creatively, this is my choice. And suddenly everything lined up and I got to do it. And I felt very, very focused doing that show. I was nervous. I was overwhelmed. It was a lot on my shoulders, but it did feel like my wax on, wax off moment where it was like, this is everything I've been working towards. and then, you know, made it through the pilot without getting fired. Of course, I watch it. I think it's a disaster. I think I'm a disaster in it. It's never going to go. Once other people see it, they have to reassure me that I did an okay job. The show gets picked up, and it is incredibly difficult to do. I love it. It's deeply rewarding. I would have done it for a million years, and I don't, I'm not being glib when I say that. I would have done that show for as long as they would have let me do it. The message of the show in terms of what it was saying about how we perceive people with mental illness meant a lot to me and felt very different than how I had seen that depicted in other shows, which is, here is a guy who is mentally ill. It is not his defining characteristic. The show is not him learning how to be sane. The show is him learning how to be powerful within who he is. And that crazy was not the only characteristic of this guy, but it filters into every single aspect of who he is. That was huge for me. So I cared a lot. I put everything into it. We're doing it for months. The show's going to premiere very shortly afterwards. So as we're filming the show, in these long, difficult days that are physically taxing, press is coming on and interviewing me, and there's this thing of being surrounded by people who are like, this might be a big show. You might be a leading man after this. You might this. You might that. You know? I'm not able to separate that from the making of the show because it's all happening in such a condensed timeline. And there's a degree to which now I'm a little bit older and I wonder, do I want that? Do I want to be famous, you know, or do I just want to work? Do I just want to do this show? I'm questioning all of this, but also I wonder, is this a bird in the hand moment? Am I going to be able to sort of write my own meal ticket after this and get to play parts that I haven't gotten to play, right? And agents and everyone around me are sort of saying, like, this is your moment to capitalize on it, all of this. So it's within that, when I am filming the first season of The Tick, that I get the audition for the Woody Allen movie. Which, if you are an actor in New York City, you know, at least until recently, it's sort of like Woody Allen is the thing in movies, Law and Order is the thing in TV, right? Here are these two venerable things that are constantly going, that are essentially New York, that always have these parts for character actors, for people on the rise, right? And it's sort of like a rite of passage thing. You get a stamp if you've been on a Law & Order episode. You get a stamp if you had a line in a Woody Allen movie. Now, I'm at a point where I was a fan of a tremendous amount of his work, but also I've spent my entire life with people fucking comparing me to this guy, which went from a point of frustration, I'm not Woody Allen. I don't want people to see me as Woody Allen. To at some point, as I'm getting into this very obsessive, trying to control my career thing, going, fine, I'm Woody Allen. If that works, then I'm Woody Allen, right? If that's how people see me, then I'm going to turn that into the thing. Not do an impression of him, but if that's what people read me, I'm a short Jewish New Yorker with glasses and I'm flummoxed by things, right? I'm overwhelmed and I'm quippy. Fine, then that's the thing. If you think I'm the young Woody Allen, if that gets me a job, then I'm doing that, right? So at the moment I get that audition, I'm just going, well, there we go. That's the thing. I've been working towards this. Everyone says I'm this guy. I guess I'm supposed to do this. I'm on a TV show. I'm finally getting the call. I guess it means that shit's happening, right?
Yeah, it's all paying off. It's all coming around.
Right. And there is this sort of status that comes with being asked to do one of his movies because he's notoriously picky, you know, and such great performers are in it and people get their first roles in these movies and all of that sort of shit. There's also the aspect of this that is like he's very infamous for how he works. He doesn't do multiple takes. It's mostly wide shots. You have to know all of your dialogue in advance. You might have to do a 10-minute take as opposed to TV where it's very stitched together. This is kind of an advanced ropes course of on-camera acting because of his very particular style that you're not going to mess with. All of this being said, I also, at this point, fundamentally believe Dylan Farrow. I had gone through that. Her first op-ed for the New York Times was a couple years before this. I think it was when Blue Jasmine came out. She, up until that point, had never spoken as an adult. And I took the stance that a lot of people took of just like, well, none of us really know what happened. But from the moment she wrote that piece and she's speaking as an adult and speaking clearly, I sort of went, well, I fundamentally kind of believe her story. Anyone can poke holes in it and point out inconsistencies. There are inconsistencies on both sides. But I'm more inclined to believe her. I believe this account. talk about sound mix. Now, as I get to this point of the story, lightning cracks outside my window. A storm is brewing.
Yeah, little over the top sound editor.
Yep, a little on the nose, gilding the lily there. I am very much also, and you know, I say this with shame, at a point that I think comes from a cynicism of being kicked around the industry for 5 or 6 years at that point of, well, what are you going to do? Bad people stay in the industry forever. Separate the art from the artist. What am I? Take a stand? What are you fucking talking? Turn down a job? You know? There's this part of me that is just fundamentally like, yeah, I believe this guy is guilty and I would not be in a Woody Allen movie. So I audition for it. I audition for it again. The second audition is with him. And I do feel weirdness when I am in the same room as him. Not weirdness because of how he's treating me, but weirdness as, oh, this is no longer an abstract figure. This is a guy I'm engaging with and I'm thinking about how I think about him. Not as an artist, but as a human being and what I think he has perhaps done, right? Then they offer me the part. In the time between that callback audition and when they offered me the part, the show wraps. We do the press tour for The Tick. I do another movie. I go literally straight from like The Tick wraps to filming another thing, which I shouldn't have done. I say that just because I was so fucking burned out. I really needed to recuperate. But instead, I filmed a movie because my career's got momentum. What am I going to do? Stop? This is that moment I've been waiting for. So I film another movie, and in between that, I'm flying to different countries to do Tick press. And my brain is beyond fried. I don't say this to excuse myself as sort of being an impaired mental state, but this was a manic phase of my life, right? I'm running on fumes. I was dating someone at the time, and she was the first person to say to me, why would you want to do a Woody Allen movie? Everyone else around me went, wow, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. That's a big deal. And she said, why would you want to do that? This and this, this and that. Don't you think that's going to age poorly? Don't you feel like there's a reckoning coming up? All this sort of shit. And I sort of went like, yeah, but what are you going to do? Not do it? But that sticks with me. And even after we break up, her voice is the one echoing in my head. And I had a night when we were doing Tick press and we were in England. I'm sorry, this is such a long answer, but I, you know, there's a lot of thought that is in this, and especially with some years distance now. Valerie Curry, an amazing actor and friend of mine who played my sister on The Tick. We're at a bar in London, both exhausted, doing Tick press. And I tell her, like, and I auditioned for it. And I feel like they're maybe going to give me this part because I kind of did a good job. And I'm now questioning whether or not I would want to do this, right? And in talking to her about it, I go like, okay, I think I turn it down. I think I turn it down. Hopefully they just don't give me the part, and if they call me and they offer me the part, I turn it down. I just think I don't need to do it, and I'm going to feel uncomfortable about it, and like career, whatever, be damned, I don't do it. Then a couple weeks later, at the Tick premiere, I'm there wearing a fucking suit. I've been filming this other movie. I'm finally done with the press tour. I'm sick. I have a cold. I have a 100-degree temperature. It should be the biggest night of my life. I'm being propped up by fucking drugs and, you know, prescription drugs. Uh-huh. And just trying to stay sane. The premiere happens. People clap. My parents look at me with pride. I feel like your kid made good. And my agent turns to me and says, in front of my parents, and the news gets even better, you just got offered the part in the Woody Allen movie. So what I thought would be a phone call where someone would say, you're offered the part, and I will say, you know, actually, I've been thinking about it, and I think I don't want to do it, is now a moment where everyone's like, oh, my God.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I do not have, in that moment, I feel in me the power to say, actually, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
And what happens is me spending the next 3 weeks trying to build up the courage to quit the movie. Which I obviously did not do.
Yeah. Right.
And I chalk that up more to cowardice than anything else. It was the cowardice of who turns down a Woody Allen movie. Everyone is going to think I'm insane. Your morality be damned. That's nice. Applaud you for thinking about it. But no one turns that down. Everyone I talk to goes, you don't turn that down. Right. And like, I get it, but come on, like what? No one takes a stand in the stupid industry. And I draft the emails. I plan the phone calls. I want to quit. I don't do it. And when it boils down to it, I mean, and you can sort of you can see. I can see. I still have the email saved from my managers frantically being like, the costume designers have been trying to schedule a fitting with you for a week. Why aren't you responding? And the answer is, I want to quit. I didn't want to go to a fucking costume fitting. And I was trying to build the courage to say, because I quit, I don't want to be in this movie. Some other actor wants to do it, let him do it, who feels less conflicted about this. But I don't do it. And what I ultimately use to justify the decision, and I really only feel like I accept I'm going to do this maybe 2 days before I film. Like, I really keep thinking I'm going to quit until the weekend before, the Monday when I'm going to film, is I'm interested in this as a work experience. His process is unique. This is a guy to work with. I originally wanted to be a film director. That's what I went to college for before I dropped out very abruptly. I still maybe want to do that someday. I learn on set. This is a unique filmmaker. It's one scene. I just want to do this experientially. And what I tell myself is, and if people ask me about it later why I did it, I will say, I believe Dylan Farrow. I did it for the experience. I hold those two things fundamentally to be true. I go do it and immediately feel terrible. Like, from the moment I show up, I feel terrible. I feel guilty. It's the first day of filming on the entire film. Timothy Chalamet and Selena Gomez are in it. Selena Gomez is a superstar. Timothy Chalamet is the dude who's about to break. It's Woody Allen filming an exterior in Greenwich Village. And unsurprisingly, the set is swarmed with paparazzi. And I am borderline having a panic attack about being captured on set. And that's a big warning sign that I am in a job that is all about capturing me on camera doing this right, to be screened for the public. Yeah. And I am terrified and hiding when the paparazzi show up because I don't want anyone to see that I'm in this movie. The guilt was there immediately. I feel very weird when I'm engaging with him and the whole operation and all of that. You know, there was nothing untoward that happened on my very limited time on set. But it was the most unpleasant shoot day I've ever had. And not just because of what was going on inside of me. I will say it was a very dysfunctional shoot. So that also compounds it. That it was like, well, I told myself I was doing this just for the experience because I wanted to see this high-level, legendary filmmaker, you know, who's been doing things his way for decades. And it sucks. It's a fucking mess. It's terrible. And I'm going to people who on the crew who have worked with him for years and going, is this what it's usually like? And they're like, no, this is everything collapsing. This is like the house of cards falling, right? So the whole thing is just entirely unpleasant for me. And I go, well, I stand by what I was going to say. When people ask me about this later, I will say I did this for the experience. It was a bad decision. I believe that she's telling the truth. I believe Dylan Farrow, that's my line, right? And I think that will be something to be an actor who says, I shouldn't have done this movie and I think he's guilty rather than the people who sort of deny it and go like, I don't know. And then Me Too happens. It happens weeks later. It was a very compressed timeline. And I have shot that movie. I finished this other movie. I finished the Tick Press. And the last thing is New York Comic Con. And I've been working nonstop for months and months and months at this point and all these different things and losing my mind. And the thing I told myself is I'm going to go to Paris and I'm going to hole myself up in an apartment alone for a month and just decompress and reset. I need a break to fucking catch my mental health, right? And this New York Comic Con's the first week of October. The Woody movie shot sometime in September. And that's my final fucking obligation for the year. At that point, I decompress and figure out what the fuck to do next. And that weekend of Comic-Con, the first New York Times Harvey Weinstein story breaks.
Changes the story a little bit.
Changes the story a lot. I'm already dealing with this guilt of this and knowing how I'm going to speak about this if people ask me about it. But the idea of being proactive about it is not a thing in my mind necessarily until that point. And I'm reading these stories and I'm doing my final round of Tick Press at this convention. And then I go to Paris. And as I'm in Paris, I'm reading these stories just start to come out like a fucking a dam breaking, right? suddenly there are more and more pieces, and it's not just Weinstein, it's extending to other people. And it's not just high-level journalistic institutions, it's also just tweets. It's people just tweeting out the, I'll add to the choir, this person also, blah, 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 right? And it's all just building, and I'm losing my mind. I am feeling so incredibly guilty. And beyond that, I feel like I'm part of the problem. I'm part of the system. I'm part of the people who have propped this up, who have turned the other way, who have let people to continue. How dare I have held this belief that he is guilty and also have done this job and rationalized it to myself? And I feel like I need to say something because I am going to burst. And so at 3 o'clock in the morning, if not later, Paris time, I just start tweeting. At this point, the show has premiered. It seems to be well-liked, but it is not Stranger Things, right? It didn't blow up. I didn't overnight become a star. There does not feel like there is more attention on me than there was before the show premiered. So I'm like, okay, I'm a guy who's a face of a thing, but it's not like anyone knows my name and knows anything, and I can tweet this. And very naively, I thought to myself, I can tweet this, and it will mostly be to my friends who follow me. I have 8,000 followers or whatever, right? There's some percentage of fans and a lot of people where I just know them from Twitter and people I know in real life. And I just kind of want to get this off my chest and tell everyone how I'm feeling about this thing. I'm not included in any press releases of this movie. I'm not trying to get ahead of anything in particular, you know? I'm not the face of this. I have one scene, but it's been eating me up. And I'm in an apartment by myself and all I'm doing is thinking about this. So I tweet this shit out at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it goes viral instantly. Immediately. And, you know, I think people talk about...
You tweet that you regret doing the movie, that you wish you had not done the movie.
The first tweet, I believe, was, I want to get something off my chest. I took a part in Woody Allen's new movie. I believe that he's guilty. I donated my entire salary to RAIN. That was my tweet. And I tweet it, and within, 5 seconds, I get 5 texts from people I know saying, holy shit, what did you just do? And that's when I realized, oh, fuck, did I do something more than I thought I did? Is this actually going to extend? I thought this will probably be a thing talked about in comedy circles and Twitter, because that's where I'm mostly known. You know, I might be the main character of certain spheres of Twitter for a day. I did not think that within an hour, it would be international headlines. But no one had done that up until that point. I was not strategically trying to do something in that way. It was primarily an attempt for me to absolve my guilt and just sort of say, I don't want there to be any confusion. Here's where I stand on everything to the people who actually know me. I didn't think it would become that much of a thing. And so then I keep tweeting. Because suddenly it's like the weird engagement of it's like, I need to explain myself further and further and further, which I, you know, realize is a mistake.
I imagine it's not calming you down to it's not a catharsis. It's building up the tension.
Correct. And with every new thing I tweet to try to clarify or explain where I was coming from or the thought process or all these different things, you know, oh, I was a struggling actor for 7 years. It's very scary to turn down any job. You think everyone, your reps are going to drop you if you're turning down a big movie, all these things. I just was a coward and I didn't have the power in myself to turn it down, you know, taking full responsibility for this. But, you know, just talking through all these messy thoughts.
Sure.
But not fully absorbing that these are going to become tomorrow's articles. Yeah. That my stream of consciousness is now at will be the center of a discourse for 12 hours. Of course, we're in the Me Too movement. 12 hours after that, something else happens and there's a bigger story. But there was 12 hours there where I was trending and my face was everywhere and I was on international newspapers and it was very, very fucking bizarre. And it was in so many ways, you talk about what that does for my mental health. That is a boiling point of my anxiety, you know, my sort of guilt, all these sorts of things that were bubbling out of me and caused me to do this thing that was not strategic. It was not a career move. You know, I think certain people like to think, oh, this is this guy trying to like have his cake and eat it too. And it's like, you have to understand that was the most destructive thing I could have done to my career at that moment. Later, other actors who have worked with him start to speak out. And then it becomes a, that's the PR move. That's the thing these guys do. Here's the Notes app apology they all post. And I think in retrospect, I get lumped in with that. And I think there is a thing where I would contend that I am far and away the least famous person who made any kind of statement about it.
Probably.
Everyone else who did it kind of did it. And I'm not casting aspersions or questioning their motivations in doing it. But there was a public outcry for, you need to weigh in on this, right? Many of the other statements were people in interviews being asked, would you work with Woody Allen again? Or someone who's in a press cycle being asked, what was that like for you? Or trying to get ahead of the story by doing it. I think there was a period of time where a lot of people like me were questioning what they had previously thought was acceptable within a career, which things they could compartmentalize or contextualize or justify to themselves, and no longer sort of absolving themselves of responsibility within a system that was innately fucked. But I don't have a publicist. I'm not putting this out in a prepared way. It is a very messy chain of thoughts from someone who is having a panic attack and has been in a psychological spiral for days at that point in time. And I think there's a resentment that brews of like, this guy's doing this. It's virtue signaling. He's trying to get ahead of something. He's doing this to advance his own career. When in fact, it really was kind of a self-destruct button on my career. And I knew that. That was the choice I was making. I felt so shitty about everything that I said I would rather deal with the repercussions of this now by doing the more destructive thing. But it was a very weird hurricane to find myself in the eye of. It's especially weird to suddenly be a name that is being thrown around that much a month or less after a TV show that was supposed to be the thing that makes you a star doesn't, you know?
Right,
like, oh,
right,
suddenly
right.
Now everyone's talking about me and not for the reason I would want. And I think it also then becomes the thing that most people know me for. Like, I think for a long time, if not ever, be the autocomplete on my Google, you know? And I think people go, oh, that's the guy who did this thing. And they will speculate about what my intentions were there. You know, I don't try to present it as some moral stand or some high ground. I did not know what I was doing. As I said, it was primarily me just feeling fucking awful and feeling like I needed to do something and not thinking about how it would actually play. I do take some sense of joy in the fact that I do think it kickstarted more of a conversation. And I think good came of it. And when a lot of other actors sort of spoke out about it, they also would make donations to RAIN that sort of became accidentally a template that people would follow. And I think that template did good and raised a lot of money in that sense. Obviously, if I had the chance to do it over, the thing I would do is not do the fucking movie. Like, that's the genuine thing I wish I hadn't done. I don't wish I hadn't tweeted it. I might have tweeted things differently. I might have conducted myself. But it was interesting to me how even several years after that, I was dating someone. I had been dating her for probably about 6 months at that point. And she asked me, do you mind if I ask you about the Woody Allen thing? And I said, no, I'm fine to talk about it. And she said, what was like the planning of that? Like, was that all of your publicists talking together and planning out what order people were going to come out in? And I realized, like, this is a person who loves me and is in a relationship with me and has been with me for 6 months. And that's her perception of what happened here, that it was part of an orchestrated PR thing. And it wasn't, you know?
It's just a lived experience, yeah.
It was an odd lived experience. And, you know, I've I had a lot of weird psychological fallout from that in a lot of different ways, but it also did kind of shift for me, just like after years of being so single-minded about my career, realizing like there's a lot of this I don't want to be a part of. There's a lot of this I don't want to engage with. And there are things I fundamentally cannot live with myself doing. And career success or status or whatever is never going to be able to override my innate, irrepressible sense of Jewish guilt. Not that I will never err or fuck up again, you know? But it was this shift for me where it's just like, okay, my priority is I want to fucking try to live a life on my terms, and I would like to also do whatever work I can that doesn't clash with that. But the script got flipped a little bit at that point of there's a lot I'm not going to do. And I'm pretty comfortable with leaving a lot of opportunities on the table just because I don't want to fucking... I don't want to get caught up enough in the system that I lose that objectivity.
I think at the end of this, if I just drop in you playing Watto on the George Lucas talk show, it's just going to scramble everybody's heads, and I might just have to do it.
Everyone's brain. Yeah. Yeah.
That's Griffin Newman, and I will scramble your brains in a minute here. But first, I want to offer some thoughts on Griffin Newman and his self-management. Yes, there's depression and anxiety there, has been for a long time. And yeah, the career path, which he loves and which he excels, performer in the entertainment industry, is especially difficult for people with those particular mental obstacles. So those are his challenges, right? That's the combat arena. What I think Griffin does well is that he keeps close tabs on how the depression and anxiety are manifesting in himself, and he's honest about it. In the present moment, he checks himself and tries to determine why he's making the choices that he is making, and he regularly looks back on decisions from the past to figure out what had guided them so he can use that wisdom going forward. And he's not exactly easy on himself, but he doesn't beat himself up either. Okay, so one more thing, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it. There's this thing, this live event, this video show called the George Lucas Talk Show. It has its roots in New York alternative comedy. Comedian Connor Ratliff plays the director George Lucas, and he interviews talk show guests who are themselves. Griffin Newman plays Watto, the weird pod racing guy from episode 1 of Star Wars, and Watto is the sidekick. Here, Griffin Newman, as Watto, meets Tony Hale, the actor, who played Forky in Toy Story 4.
The Toy Story franchise is the most existential of all populist film franchises, because it's about the constant process of needing to reframe yourself with an understanding of the fact that the world does not revolve around you. It is about the understanding that you are but a very, very small part of a very large world.
Yep.
There is value in that, to understand your role and your place and your relationships to the people around you.
Yeah. It's also, I would say, a balance between you have kind of an insignificance in the world, and at the same time, you have great significance.
Exactly.
So it's a weird kind of yin and yang of it.
Right, and Forky single-handedly turns that subtext into text. Forky, I value his contribution to the franchise, really bringing those discussions to the forefront.
Next time on Depression Mode, you get the feeling someone close to you is having some trouble, stress, depression, anxiety, some kind of mental thing. You want to help, but before you dive in, know your limits.
It's not really your job to fix this person's external problems or internal problems. And always remember that, because we take it on. We feel it with them. We throw ourselves into the canyon so that they're not alone. And suddenly we're both just feeling this misery together, and it is shitty.
We have effective strategies for helping other people while taking care of yourself, because both are important. You know how on a plane they say to put your own oxygen mask on before helping others? It's like that. If people support our show through small donations, we continue to exist. If not, we don't. If you donate, you make Depression Mode. And if you have donated, thank you. If you haven't, oh, it's so easy. You can find a level that works for you and sign right up, MaximumFun.org/join. Also, give our sponsors a shot. Use those discount codes they offer. That stuff is tracked. You're getting good stuff cheaper. You're helping the show. We love it when you recommend Depression Mode to friends. It's our best marketing. Also, something that matters a lot, hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write reviews. That kind of thing helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations going. I want you to know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free, 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text the word HOME to 741-741. Let us know who you want me to interview, what issues you want to hear more about. We take requests. You can send us an electric mail, depressmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. Great talk going on over there. I stop by sometimes. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. That comes out twice a week. I'm on Twitter at John Moe, all one word. Hi, credits listeners. There's a species of ant believed to only exist on Broadway in Manhattan and only at the little woodsy medians where Broadway intersects 63rd Street and 76th Street. Those two places, nowhere else in the world. Other ants can't afford those rents, I guess. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, I'm Stacy from Murray, Utah, USA. And I just wanted to let you know that even if it feels like it, this isn't going to last forever. Hang in there.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.